Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Chudaikin. Rare in the world of advertising, it turns out the cotton industry's claim that cotton is the fabric of our lives proves true. Sven Beckert's award-winning work, The Empire of Cotton, A Global History, explains why. Beckert tells us in his introduction,
"This book is the story of the rise and fall of the European-dominated empire of cotton. But because of the centrality of cotton, its story is also the story of the making and remaking of global capitalism, and with it of the modern world. Foregrounding a global scale of analysis, we will learn how, in a remarkably brief period, enterprising entrepreneurs and powerful statesmen in Europe recast the world's most significant manufacturing industry by combining imperial expansion and slave labor with new machines and wage workers."
The Empire of Cotton is the winner of the Bancroft Prize, the leading award for works of American history, and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Since Memphis was historically the heart of cotton country, I'm so happy to have Sven Beckert, the Laird Bell Professor of History at Harvard, with me today on Counterpoint. Beckert will be giving a free and open lecture at Rhodes College on September 17th at 6 p.m., followed by a book signing of The Empire of Cotton. It's great to have you with us, Sven.
It's good to be here.
The Empire of Cotton covers the 5,000-year-long story of cotton. What were the origins of cotton manufacturing, and how did it develop into the world's most important industry?
Cotton has a very, very long history, and probably most of us are not really quite aware of the length of that history, because usually when we think in the United States and Tennessee and elsewhere, if we think about cotton, we usually think, you know, perhaps about the past 200 or 300 years, but not the really long history of cotton. But to understand the most recent history, I think you need to understand also that very long history. And approximately 5,000 years ago, as much as we can tell, farmers in what today is Pakistan, for the first time, harvested cotton fibers and used these fibers to spin a thread and then weave fabric. That skill of harvesting cotton fibers and manufacturing cloth out of cotton then migrated from India into many different parts of the world, into Western Asia, into what is today Turkey. It migrated east into what today is China and Japan. At approximately the same time, cotton manufacturing also evolved independent from the South Asian experience. It evolved in what today is Peru, where farmers also discovered the great properties of cotton fibers. They spun that fiber and they wove it into cotton textiles, some of which are still existing to this day. So cotton emerged in principally in three different areas of the world, in South Asia, where it probably emerged first, then in Latin America, and last but not least, also on the African continent. And it spread from the places where it first emerged throughout Africa, throughout Latin America, Central America, even partly into North America. And as I mentioned before, it spread throughout Asia. And eventually, approximately 1,000 years ago, so around the year 1000, cotton manufacturing had probably become the world's most important industry, which was perhaps not surprising because cotton, as you know, has some very pleasant properties. It lends itself to producing a pleasant cloth, and cloth was a need that people had in many different parts of the world. So millions of people already grew cotton. They manufactured yarn and cloth way before the Industrial Revolution or way before cotton ever came to what then eventually became the United States.
So even though your book traces this 5,000-year-long history, the heart of the book is really about the lost 500 years. Part of it is about how the history of cotton illuminates the history of capitalism and, by extension, the modern world. You write at one point, "European trade in cotton textiles tied together Asia, the Americas, Africa, and Europe in a complex commercial web. Never before in the four millennia of the history of cotton had such a global spanning system been invented. Never before had the products of Indian weavers paid for slaves in Africa to work on the plantations in the Americas to produce agricultural commodities for European consumers." So tell listeners how the Empire of Cotton expands the history of globalization, which is usually understood only in terms of, let's say, the last four decades, to 400 years of world history.
Cotton has a very long history, and it was a very vibrant manufacturing industry in many, many different parts of the world. But the core argument of the book is that this very vibrant industry is radically transformed with the advent of capitalism and that also this very vibrant industry is very central to the emergence of capitalism. And thus looking at the history of this industry allows us to develop a new kind of understanding of the long history of capitalism, including, as you just mentioned, the history of globalization. And so basically, cotton was a very vibrant industry in many, many different parts of the world, but it was not really much of a presence on the continent of Europe. Indeed, most Europeans before, let's say, the 17th century had no experience with cotton fabrics whatsoever, and there was very little knowledge about how to manufacture cotton fabrics in Europe. Beginning in the late 15th century, but then especially in the 16th century, European states expanded quite rapidly and quite radically into different parts of the world. So first to the Americas, then also into Africa, and last but not least also into Asia. And in the process of expanding, Europeans saw that this was a very vibrant industry, which had a lot of manufacturers and also a lot of consumers in many different parts of the world. But they also began to understand that if they can bring these cotton goods into Europe, there were very significant markets for these cotton goods in Europe itself. And thus, they inserted themselves ever more into the pre-existing networks of cotton growing and cotton manufacturing in many different parts of the world. And what they in effect did is they began to export manufactured cotton fabrics from India and sold them in Africa, as you just mentioned, and they also sold them on the European continent. Then eventually, Europeans began to manufacture many more cotton fabrics. They began to understand how this can be done without having yet invented any new machines. That would come much later. That would only come in the second half of the 18th century. And now they developed a huge demand for raw cotton. And this raw cotton at first came from what is now Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. Some of it came from Western Africa. But eventually they searched for new ways to produce raw cotton for European manufacturing. And increasingly, they produced that cotton first in the Caribbean and then in Brazil and eventually in what was to become the United States. And in those territories, they introduced something that was radically new within the cotton empire, something that had never existed before. And that was A, the monocultural production of raw cotton for distant export markets. And they took the land from the indigenous inhabitants, which had lived on these lands for many centuries or millennia. And then, of course, they imported enslaved Africans to work on these cotton plantations to produce raw cotton for European manufacturers. And this system of combining Asian technology, African labor, and American land expanded quite significantly already before the Industrial Revolution, before the invention of new techniques of manufacturing cotton textiles. Once that happened in the late 18th century, first in Great Britain and then in France and other parts of Europe, and eventually also in North America, the demand for cotton increased tremendously. And therefore, this combination of lands taken from indigenous people and labor taken from enslaved Africans exploded beyond anything that anybody was able to envision, let's say, by the mid-18th century.
And this really gets to the heart of one of your key arguments, which is that industrial capitalism depended upon what you call war capitalism. You've been talking about that already. You say it encapsulates three forces that were working together: imperial expansion, expropriation, and slavery. You know, many scholars refer to this period as the period of merchant capitalism. Why do you choose to term it war capitalism? And what specifically do you mean by that term?
Mercantile capitalism is perfectly fine with me. It's also a good term. What is really important to the argument of the book is that capitalism has a history and it changes quite significantly over time. And the kind of capitalism that I describe for the 17th or first half of the 18th century is really quite different from, let's say, the modern capitalism that we know today. But it wasn't just kind of another part of the history of capitalism, but it was in some ways a precondition for the emergence of this later industrial capitalism, an industrial capitalism that would eventually do away with what I term war capitalism. And, you know, the character of what I call war capitalism that rested very much on colonial expansion of European states. It rested very much on the expropriation of the land of native peoples, principally in the Americas. It rested also on armed trade, in which many European merchants engaged in the 17th and 18th century, especially in regard to Asia. And then it came to rest very much on the institution of slavery, which was, as I mentioned earlier, so important to the mobilization of labor to make possible the production of all that cotton, that this new industrial economy that was now emerging in New England and Western Europe, that all that cotton could be produced in the Americas. First, I just described that word. It struck me that, you know, this is a word quite fundamentally different from modern-day capitalism. You know, the term mercantile capitalism seemed a little tame. It didn't quite seem to get at the enormous degree of violence or coercion that went along with it. And that's how I came up with this term of war capitalism.
Now, you state at one point the beating heart of this new system was slavery. And you develop Eric Williams' thesis from his 1944 book, Capitalism and Slavery, that capitalism was literally created on the backs of slavery. You show how the laboratory for plantation slavery originated in the Caribbean. You already alluded to that. And then really after the Haitian Revolution was imported and developed in the United States. And you declare at one point, by the 1780s, slaves in the West Indies and South America produced the vast majority of cotton sold on world markets. And this explosive combination of slavery and conquest fueled the Industrial Revolution all the way to 1861. One of the things that's really fascinating about the book is you explain how slavery as it developed was not an antiquated form of production that was bound to recede in the modern world, but was actually almost a new mechanism for producing goods. Can you elaborate on that a little bit for listeners?
Most of us, when we think about capitalism and when we think about slavery, we see the one to be the exact opposite of the other. When we think about capitalism, most of us will think about markets, about contracts, about the rule of law, and about wage labor. And most importantly, we think about the expansion of human freedom. And of course, that story is partly true. This is a significant part of the history of capitalism. But, you know, I didn't write about capitalism in the abstract. I very much tried to write a book that is about capitalism in action, the actual history of capitalism as it unfolded over the past 400 or 500 years. And we cannot help but see that in that story, coercion, violence, and slavery, as you just mentioned, does play a very significant role. And I think the book shows in an empirical way that slavery and capitalism are not always mutually contradictory, but that indeed the expansion of slavery and the expansion of capitalism went hand in hand, especially in the 18th and then until in the first half of the 19th century. And so they were not mutually contradictory. They were part of the same system of the emergence of global capitalism. Of course, when it comes to cotton, the importance of slavery to cotton comes to a rather sudden end in 1861 or at latest then in 1865. But for the first 80 years after the Industrial Revolution, which began in Britain in the 1780s, for the first 80 years of the Industrial Revolution, which was at its core an industrial revolution that was about cotton manufacturing, slavery was absolutely essential to that industrial revolution, and therefore that industrial capitalism that now characterizes the modern world very much came out of this earlier dependence on slavery and imperial expansion and land expropriation and so on.
So I don't want listeners to end up having this sound like it's too abstract, as long as you remember the fact that we're really talking about the way in which cotton was produced and then developed into commodities. One gets clear that you're talking about the way in which this really works on the ground. So in addition to slavery, you also spend a lot of time in the book talking about the role of states in the development of capitalism. And one of the things your book does is to explode the myth that there is such a thing as free markets, since you show the entire history of capitalism depended and really continues to depend on the role of states. You write, "What the British example shows is the importance of the state's capacity to forge conditions conducive to industrialization. Without a powerful state capable of legally, bureaucratically, infrastructurally, and militarily penetrating its own territory, industrialization was all but impossible. Forging markets, protecting domestic industry, creating tools to raise revenues, policing borders, and fostering changes that allowed for the mobilization of wage workers were crucial." Can you expand on the point about the role of states in the history that you're telling?
When we think about the state, and if we think about government, and if we think about capitalism, we see them as kind of mutually contradictory. The more state you have, the less capitalism, and the less state, the more capitalism. And that's, especially in the United States, it's an argument that is often made and it's also often made in contemporary political debates. As a historian, I look at this question of how is the expansion of states and how is the expansion of capitalism actually related in history? And unfortunately, for people who believe in the trope of the mutual contradictory emergence of capitalism and states, I think just the opposite is true. And one of the core arguments of the book is that strong states and capitalism emerge hand in hand, and one enables the other. Obviously, strong states are very much dependent on a thriving capitalist economy because they tax the resources that come out of this economy, and that allows the state to become a much stronger institution. But the argument goes the other way around as well, namely that entrepreneurs, business people, are very much historically, are very much dependent on a strong and assertive state that can get certain things done. It can, for example, protect the national territory. In the case of cotton, the state is involved in the appropriation of industrial technology that is important to cotton manufacturing. The state is extremely important in securing markets for cotton textiles, very important in securing territory on which raw cotton can grow for European industry. So one historically emerged with the other, and in the end was usually the strong states that came to characterize some parts of the world, principally Europe and North America. Those strong states were exactly the places that came to industrialize first. And places in the world that had weak states or non-existent states or were subject to colonial rule, these were the parts of the world that industrialized either not at all or much, much later.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm talking to Sven Beckert, author of The Empire of Cotton, A Global History, who will be in Memphis on September 17th at 6 p.m. at Rhodes College to talk about and sign his award-winning book. Now, Sven, let's move forward to the Civil War. The chapter on the Civil War is titled, A War Reverberates Around the World, and it shows the global ramifications of what you and other historians term the Second American Revolution. What was the global impact of the Civil War?
Historians have written more books on the American Civil War than anybody could possibly read in a lifetime, and so it was kind of a risky endeavor to tell a kind of slightly different story about the American Civil War. And what I basically tried to do, as I tried to do with the entire book, I tried to globalize the history of cotton and here in this instance, the history of the American Civil War. And that what I basically argue is that the American Civil War is the world's first raw materials crisis. As mentioned earlier, cotton had become extremely important to European industrialization. It had become extremely important to European economies. It had become extremely important to the social stability of European states, in which more and more people were engaging in wage work in cotton factories. So the supply of cotton was of great significance to European industry and to European states. But as you know, in 1861, for a variety of reasons, the exports of cotton from the United States to Europe basically came to an end. And the United States had provided approximately 80% of all the cotton used in European industry before the American Civil War. So that led to a serious crisis in the industrial areas of Europe, in Alsace, and especially in Lancashire and various parts of the United Kingdom. Thus, European entrepreneurs and European politicians tried to find ways to secure cotton from other areas of the world, not from the United States. They had tried to do so before. They had tried to do so in the 1820s and the 1830s, but they had never really quite succeeded because they hadn't succeeded in transforming the countryside in these parts of the world as they had transformed the countryside in North America and in the Caribbean and in Brazil. But by 1860 and thereafter, they begin to be able to transform the countryside in other parts of the world, especially in regards to cotton, especially in Egypt and especially in India. And it was increasingly sharecroppers in these parts of the world who began to supply raw cotton for European industry. And suddenly, European manufacturers and European politicians began to understand that their great dependence on slave labor was not quite as great as they had imagined it to be. And a new system of labor emerged first in India and Egypt and elsewhere, but then obviously also in the United States post-slavery after 1865, in which now sharecroppers began to grow vast quantities and ever-increasing quantities of ever less expensive cotton for European industry. So the American Civil War is a turning point, I think, in the history of global capitalism, because this is the moment in which, for the first time, it becomes clear that the global countryside can be integrated into the global capitalist economy without resorting to slave labor.
I guess I want you to expand a little bit more on that point, because at the end of the chapter on the Civil War, you discuss how the new challenge now was getting newly freed blacks to go back to raising cotton. So Andrew Johnson said in 1865, "Everywhere measures are being taken to force the Negroes to work and to teach them that freedom means working for wages instead of masters." Or, as the Economist put it at the same time, "If, however, complete freedom is to be the principle adopted, it is clear that the dark races must, in some way or other, be induced to obey white men willingly." How did cotton manufacturing soar to new heights after the Civil War based on the experiments developed during the war? How did they get this new form of labor to take off such that it actually became incredibly productive in the post-war period?
The quote that you just read from The Economist is truly depressing, but I think it does accurately reflect how many landowners and many politicians globally, not just in the United States, but also in Europe, thought about this, what they called the problem of cotton supply. Basically, in the wake of the American Civil War, the freed slaves had a great preference to become independent landowners and independent farmers, and to first and foremost focus on subsistence agriculture, to supply their own families with the food and the fiber that they could raise on their own land. And that was quite typical for much of the world's countryside. People all over the world had these particular kinds of preferences. But at least some people in the world depended very much on the supply of vast quantities, ever-increasing quantities of inexpensive cotton into global markets. And so in the United States, there was great pressure from the former slave owners in the American South, but also from European entrepreneurs and European politicians to make sure that the freed people in the American South would exactly not revert to subsistence agriculture, that they would not get access to land, that they would not be able to control their own labor, but that they in some ways would continue to produce cotton for world markets. And this exactly happened, and the system of labor that emerged was quite different from slavery. I think that's really important to insist on that, that emancipation was a really crucial event in the history of the United States and in the history of the world. But this does not mean that a world emerged in which coercion and violence was absent in the cotton-growing countryside, just the opposite. As you know, the political aspirations of freed people in the United States were pretty much destroyed by the 1870s. Their aspirations to get access to land was also, they did not succeed in getting access to land. They had no access to capital whatsoever. They were dirt poor. In many ways, they had much less autonomy, much less social power than, for example, farmers in West Africa at the same point in time. And as a result, you know, without any resources, without land, they were forced again to work for the people who owned the land. They entered new kinds of labor relations, namely a sharecropping. But that sharecropping, you know, they were often highly indebted to local landowners, to local merchants. They forced them to grow ever more cotton, to pay their debts. They could not make independent decisions as to what crops they would grow. They had very little control over the crops that they grew. And they lost political power. They eventually lost even the ability to vote. And a labor system, which continued to be violent and which continued to be coercive, and which, by the way, also included ever larger numbers of white farmers, not just freed African-Americans, but also included ever larger numbers of white farmers. So this new system of labor emerged, which was in some ways based on contract, but it produced ever more quantities of raw cotton for global markets with devastating economic and social effects on the long history of the American South, which basically became stuck in a quagmire of underdevelopment.
So you've been talking about the post-war period that historians term Reconstruction in the American South. But like your chapter on the Civil War, you also put that into a global frame. And you show that the coercion and violence that we're familiar with in the context of the Jim Crow South actually had a global frame to it as well, that sharecropping and tenant farming was not only an American phenomenon after the war, but it actually expanded cotton output in India, in Brazil, and in Egypt. Why was it that this new system actually proved to be more profitable and productive than cotton that had been produced by slavery previously?
In order to understand the history of capitalism, we should not just look at cities, we should not just look at manufacturing, we should not just look at industry. We should look instead at the countryside and at agriculture. in many ways, the transformation of what I call the global countryside, the people who worked in the global countryside, to make them give up on subsistence agriculture and to make them produce goods that can be exported into global markets. That was one of the core transitions and one of the core problems of the transition to global capitalism. And that was a very, very difficult process because the power of entrepreneurs and the power of politicians, statesmen, was really quite limited for a very long time in much of the world. And people, especially peasants, continued to control the land and their labor, and they were able to make decisions about what crops they grew and what they would do with them. And in some ways, the transition to slavery was exactly a response to the problem from the perspective of Western entrepreneurs to transform the global countryside. But by the last third of the 19th century, this now becomes increasingly possible. It becomes possible in the United States, as we just discussed, in terms of reconstruction, but it also becomes possible in other parts of the world. And I think that has a lot to do with the increasing power of states, because at this point now, states were able to move in new infrastructures into the global countryside, especially railroads, but also the telegraph. They were able to control agricultural populations to a much greater degree. And with the state came also merchants and traders came into that global countryside. European capital came into that countryside. And they were able to transform that countryside now to ensnare people in new kinds of labor relations, especially sharecropping, but sometimes also wage labor. For example, in northern Mexico, wage labor became quite important in cotton growing. And that then resulted in a much greater output of cotton than ever before.
Sven, today, after several hundred years of European domination of cotton capitalism, global cotton is once again concentrated in places like China and India, but it still involves 3 to 4% of the world's population. This shift began in the 1920s. Why is that the case? And who controls the cotton market today, and how is it controlled?
Capitalism is a kind of state of permanent revolution. Nothing is ever stable. This is also a history of globalization, but the history of globalization told over the past 500 years. But the way how this global economy looks constantly shifting around, and it shifts in ways that are entirely unpredictable. If you would have told somebody in Tennessee in 1850 that 150 years later, China would be at the very center of the global empire of cotton, I think people would have thought you were just completely crazy. That was not something that was easily anticipated. But that's what happened, and that's one of the fundamental qualities of capitalism, this constant rearrangement of peoples and places and economic relations all around the world. And one of the, you know, big stories that the book tells is how that cotton industry, how this empire of cotton moved from Asia, moved from Latin America, moved from Africa onto the continent of Europe and into the United States. This was a radical spatial rearrangement of this industry. But then in the 20th century, the spatial organization of this industry again shifted drastically. Asia more broadly became the absolute center of this industry. Today, Asia produces the largest quantity of raw cotton. It has by far the largest spinning capacity of that cotton. It has the largest weaving capacity, and it's also the largest producer of cloth worldwide. And this is a process that unfolded, let's say, over a period of approximately 80 years, but it began in the 1920s. And why did it begin? We had talked about the connection between capitalism and states. One of the outcomes of that dependence of business people on states and especially on nation states was that not just entrepreneurs drew advantages from these nation states, but increasingly also all these millions of workers who ended up working in textile mills. And they managed to go on strike, they organized unions, they gained access to political power, they were able to better their working conditions. And that was a very good thing. But one of the results of this was that, of course, production costs in Europe and in North America for cotton textiles increased. Cotton entrepreneurs looked for new places where they could manufacture the same things with cheaper labor costs. And the United States, in many ways, was the avant-garde of this movement because, as you know, the American cotton industry already by the beginning of the 20th century began to move from New England into the American South, where labor costs were much, much lower. But eventually that industry moved much further away. It moved into Eastern Europe, it moved into India and in China, and now it's moving again into Vietnam and other parts of the world. So it had a lot to do with this ability of workers in some parts of the world to improve their working conditions and their wages.
And today, does it also have a lot to do not only with states, but also with corporations, that is with entities like Walmart and Gap that regulate everything from the production of the agriculture all the way to the spinning and weaving and production of the commodity itself and then to its shipping. I mean, is that a factor as well? So even though things are being produced in Asia, in actuality, they're still being controlled by corporate capitalism, or is that too simple?
I think it's slightly too simple because we also see the emergence of very powerful economic actors in places like Brazil, South Africa, and China and India. So it's not just a story of a European or North American giant corporations. So they do play a very, very important role. But I think what it does point to is a really quite fundamental change in the character of capitalism that is relatively recent. So we had argued that the history of globalization is a very, very long history. But I think by the last decades of the 20th century, so relatively recently, entrepreneurs became increasingly less attached to particular nation states. The state still mattered a great deal. They still needed infrastructure and market access and all kinds of other things. But they kind of picked and chose which states they could resort to. And in that way, they could play states against one another. And in that way, they emancipated themselves increasingly from their dependence of the nation state, which was good for their profitability, but it was terrible for the ability of workers all around the world to continue to improve their working conditions and their wages.
Sven Beckert, thanks so much for helping us to follow the thread of cotton from its origins to the present. In the process, helping us to understand the history of globalization, the links to slavery and empire, a new perspective on the Civil War and Reconstruction, and how things have changed really in the last 100 years in terms of how the fabric of our lives is produced. We're really looking forward to learning more about this history and how it helped to make Memphis when you visit us on September 17th at 6 p.m. at Rhodes College, where you'll sign books after your lecture. We really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.